Good morning, Your Honors. I am William Johnston, and I represent Travis Lyle on appeal, and I also represented him at the trial as well.
Rebuttal time?
Oh, 2 minutes. We've raised a number of issues for the court's consideration, but we'd start with and ask the court to reverse the conviction because of the trial court's refusal to permit Lyle to cross-examine his primary antagonist in the assault, Christopher Rowles. And the record is clear that he mentioned twice during cross-examination that he was not a fighting man, he doesn't want to be a fighting man. The first time was in response to, were you concerned about profanities? What had happened was there was an encounter outside the tavern on the sidewalk. Both groups were expressing profanities towards one another, and Mr. Rowles was asked that question and responded that he was not a fighting man. And then shortly thereafter, when he had testified that he had been punched 3 times but didn't punch back, when he asked that question, he was said, I'm not a fighting man. Okay, then what transpired was the jury was excused, and Lyle asked that the court to allow impeachment of Mr. Rowles by 3 incidents of domestic assault that taken place, one in 2011, two in 2012, allegations from a Nicole Foster that he had had assaulted her, intimidated her.
How was the fact of stalking probative of fighting?
Well, there was actually three. There were three different events, and the one that's in the record was that was primarily talked about with respect to exhibit number, I believe it was 21, was a situation where he grabbed her by the wrist, threw her down on the bed, and so forth. There was one, I believe, the primary import of it was stalking, but I believe there were, of the other two, there was actually force inflicted by Mr. Rowles upon this Miss Foster. The first entered, one was a default judgment against him when he didn't appear. The other one was after he contested the allegations before Commissioner Gross, and she determined she entered the personal protection order. So there were 2 adjudications made by courts related to complaints made against Mr. Rowles that were found to have merit. And he did, it's true, the court refused to allow us to impeach him under 404B prior to the trial. The court denied that. But when this occurred, we asked the jury to be excused, and we contend then and contend now that he clearly opened the door. The state's argument is that because this was brought up on cross-examination, we shouldn't be allowed to create a problem and then to exploit it. But as I've explained, those were the questions that were asked. They were non-responsive by him. He was attempting to use his statement that he was not a fighting man as a shield to impeach his credibility. You have to remember that there were
Why isn't an impeachment on a collateral matter?
What's that?
Why isn't the evidence that you're contending the judge refused to allow, why isn't that impeachment on a collateral matter?
It's not impeachment on a collateral. We argued that it was admissible under 404B, but with respect to this,
For what purpose?
To show that he acted in a similar scheme and plan when he bumped into Mr. Rowles and got into his face. Those were the conduct that occurred. But that was rejected. But, Your Honor, we believe that it wasn't collateral when he put in issue, in essence, his character. When he says, I'm not a fighting man, to rebut.
Well, you're mixing rules, though. 404B is not about character.
Correct. Correct.
The trial judge said that the facts of those domestic violence incidences were not similar enough to be probative of whatever it is that you were offering it for, right?
That's correct. And so, we believe that the trial court's analysis that it wasn't probative was an abuse of discretion.
You were trying to show he really was a fighting man.
Correct. Because
you're saying you were trying to impeach his credibility?
Impeach his testimony that he was not a fighting person.
But why isn't that impeachment on a collateral matter?
Because he
Because it's in essence, it's propensity evidence, isn't it? Once you fought with someone, then you must have done it this time.
No, I think, respectfully, Your Honor, I think it's different when the witness testifies that he's not a fighting man. I interpret that to be a witness injecting a character trait into the trial.
There was no self-defense instruction here, is that right, or was there?
No, there was self-defense instruction on the assaults with respect to Mr. Rawls and Nilman, the young woman who was hurt. Yes, there was self-defense instructions given on that case. And we contend that when the witness affirmatively brings it into play, witnesses should be cross-examined about that. We rely on Gelfinger, 76 Washington 2nd. So we think,
doesn't the trial judge still under Gelfiller still have discretion, even if the door is open, to assess the circumstances and determine if still more prejudicial than probative? You agree with that?
That's correct, I do. But I do believe.
Why did the trial court abuse its discretion?
The trial court said that it didn't consider the type of fighting or assaultive conduct that Mr. Rawls was engaged in, of grabbing the person by the wrist and throwing her down and this sort of thing, to be the type of fighting that would be appropriate to impeach his testimony. It wasn't of the type. Another distinction was that was a fight.
Gently rough up girls.
Well, he said that they were. Another distinction was that the person was a stranger, that Mr. Rawls had never met Mr. Lyle, but with respect to the interplay between Mr. Rawls and Ms. Foster, he obviously knew her, and that was somehow a distinction in the court's mind to distinguish what the personal protection order adjudications from his statement that he was not a fighting man. So for those reasons, you know, you can be a fighting man even if you don't fight men and you just fight women, in other words. So for those reasons, we believe that the trial court's discretion was abused. And
can we go to your affidavit of prejudice argument? I want to ask you a question. So affidavit of prejudice filed. Judge comes out, says not going to honor the affidavit. Ruling's clearly wrong. Doesn't matter why. And then he says, I'm busy today. Go on down to Judge Garrett and argue anything else you've got. Does the wrong ruling on whether to recuse in response to the affidavit of prejudice in those circumstances necessitate reversal? The ruling's wrong, but all he did after that is say go down and talk to Judge Garrett.
Right, but in this case, Your Honor.
I get to ask a hypothetical,
okay, right.
And I just did. I'm trying to figure out where does this kick in.
Okay.
Is the ruling itself, or do you have to do something after that ruling to get relief?
I never thought about that, because what happens, as I pointed out in the brief, is that motions for continuance on the status calendar are pushed over to the criminal calendar. That's where they're decided. So that wasn't done. I guess if the judge...
Because we're looking hard at what happened at that hearing, and I'm just trying to figure out, does it matter what happened after that? Or, yeah, of course it matters, because even if he's wrong on whether to recuse, if he doesn't do anything else, it just there's no reason that he should reverse.
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor, but in this case he ruled on the severance motion.
We'll come back.
All right. I'm sorry, but that is a tough question.
In 10 minutes we'll talk a little more.
May it please the Court, Hillary Thomas for the State of Washington. Unless the Court has specific questions, I wish to address the argument that this case should be overturned because of the disparagement of counsel.
I would like you to answer the question that I asked counsel. If the judge comes out and there's an affidavit of prejudice and he's just wrong, no dispute about it, just plain wrong in not honoring the request for a change of judge, and then tells everybody, go on down the hall and hear these motions heard by somebody else, and then never appears in the case again. Is it automatic reversal because he was wrong on that ruling, or does something else have to happen?
I would say it wouldn't be automatic reversal with respect to the trial, because the ruling was only with respect to that one issue, is what I would submit. So he doesn't get a do-over of the entire trial.
Why not?
Because
there any case where a judge, any case you can point to where a judge wrongly decided a motion for change of judge, where an appellate court said, no, that should have been granted, where the remedy wasn't reversal?
I don't know that I found any case in which the same judge, at the time that the ruling was made, was not the one who heard the trial.
I'm still waiting for the last sentence in your answer to my question.
So well, you're asking me whether or not...
Does every published Washington case on this issue reverse when the ruling on a motion for change of judge is made wrongfully?
I believe so, but I also believe that they all involve the fact in which the same judge reverses,
and if your position is that that's not required, what then is the rule you want us to adopt in determining when there's a remedy and when there's not a remedy?
The rule that I would ask the court to adopt is whether or not it had an impact or the affidavit of prejudice had to do with the trial itself.
And what's that rule based on?
Because I think the rule is based on the logic that you shouldn't, well, most errors are harmless unless you have structural error. And you don't have structural error unless it affects the framework of the proceedings. And so, therefore, the argument could be made that the error here was harmless with respect to, or an error with respect to, a ruling on the affidavit of prejudice, because it's not the judge that heard the trial. So there wasn't anything wrong with the trial. The affidavit of prejudice had to do with a judge, and if the judge was wrong in his ruling, then... So let's say the ruling had absolutely nothing to do with the trial. So the judge makes the ruling, but it doesn't affect the trial because that judge who should have been recused is not the one who heard the trial.
But he is the judge that denied the severance motion.
Yes, I agree.
And caused the trial to commence in a particular fashion with certain charges being put forward to the jury.
Yes, in this case, I thought your hypothetical had to do with.
But I'm just saying, but you were intimating that there was no effect upon the trial because he didn't sit on the trial. There seems to be an effect on the trial whether or not he sat on the trial.
There is an effect on the trial, but that effect, that the ruling would have been the same no matter what. The ruling by another judge would have...
Do we get to do that? Is there any case where they looked at the judge who actually tried the case? But, you know, the guy was so guilty that no judge would have made any crazy rulings that would have got this guy acquitted.
No, I think you would look at the motion to sever whether or not...
Does the judge have to make a final ruling if he makes a further tentative ruling? Is that enough to cause a remedy? Does it have to be a final ruling? What are you asking us to bite off on if it's not structural error?
I'm asking you to bite off on the fact that this court has the ability to look at a ruling as to whether or not a motion to sever was correct. Or should be, or was abuse of a discretion.
Well, let's assume it was wrong.
So,
in this case, should
so if it was wrong, and then your honors have determined that it was an abuse of discretion, and that his remedy should be a new trial.
Then we're reversing because the ruling was wrong, not because the wrong judge made it. But the issue is all about whether or not he has the right to make any rulings, right or wrong.
Yes, I understand that, but I don't think that that an affidavit of prejudice with respect to one judge who doesn't hear the trial should result in the...
What if he'd refused to suppress a confession and he didn't hear the trial? That would fall within your exception, right?
And it was wrong?
No, it was right, but he refused to suppress a confession.
And
the confession came in at trial.
Well,
but he shouldn't have made a ruling.
That he shouldn't have made a ruling.
But he should not have made the ruling.
Well, it would be in the same situation as it is here. It was a motion. Several years, it would be a motion.
So the affidavit of prejudice really accomplishes nothing.
No,
remedy unless the judge actually does make a mistake. Because it just doesn't matter.
No, it does matter. The judge shouldn't be hearing the case, and he should be, you know, recused. And in this case, he didn't hear the case. That's what the affidavit of prejudice is for.
But he did hear a motion.
He did hear a motion, but I would like to point out
about how important the motion is.
No, whether or not the ruling was wrong.
So as long as he's right, you don't get a remedy, even though he shouldn't be the one making the ruling, and the statute exists to keep him from making the ruling.
Didn't he have a remedy? He had a remedy by raising it again at trial.
He could have raised it again, Your Honor.
Isn't that his remedy? I mean, he got what he wanted, a different judge to hear the motion to sever.
He could have, and he had, in fact, an obligation to re-raise the motion to sever. And my argument with respect to his motion to sever is that he waived it by failing to re-raise it. And yes, he could have and should have re-raised the motion to sever in front of the judge who actually heard the trial.
So absent a motion to sever at trial, there can't be any harm, whatever the decision, on the motion to sever before Judge Urich. That's what you're
saying. And in this case, he waived it. He waived it whether it would have been Judge Urich or whether it would have been Judge Garrett.
So if that issue's waived, is the issue of erroneous refusal to recuse also waived, or are you simply arguing it's harmless?
I'm arguing it's harmless.
And then we go back to, got any cases that say we can engage in harmless?
No, I don't. But I don't think Your Honors need to get there. Because the case law is pretty clear that a denial of a continuance is a discretionary action. It is clear in this case that
even if it's agreed?
Even if it's agreed,
and
yes.
And you're relying on?
I think it was In re Lundquist. And so, and Court Rule 3.3.
You don't read PARA as reaching a different result if there's an agreed order, a stipulation?
That's a stipulation that's different than an agreed continuance, and those distinctions are in because the agreement in this case was that he was not going to contest the request for an objection.
The cases are clear. There's a difference if it's I won't object, but that's not what the record has here. Both counsels say we want this continued because of the Super Bowl.
But Court Rule 3.3 very explicitly says it's a discretionary decision by the judge. The judge had an opportunity to decide.
We're not construing that rule. We're construing the statute. That's its issue. And so it's entirely possible, maybe even probable, that the statute and the court rule have a different view as to what falls in the notion of discretion, especially a statute that specifically talks about calendar management.
Your Honors, but even if so, this
What's
particular
the difference between
judge
a stipulation
had
and an agreement. We agree, we stipulate.
Well, Your Honors,
I mean, does it have to be in the thesaurus as actual synonyms? And be careful, because my next question is it that agreement and stipulation are synonyms for one another?
No, they're not.
What's
they're
the
not synonyms. They didn't enter into a stipulation. A stipulation has
What's
to do with facts or
What's
law.
The difference? What's the difference between a stipulation and an agreement?
Well, and I would submit that a stipulation has legal effect. It is an actual fact. So a defendant can enter into a stipulation at trial about whether or not a fact was met. And so that's typically in the context that you see it.
And can a court refuse to allow someone to stipulate?
It doesn't have to accept the stipulation.
Yeah.
Yes.
How is that different from what we got here? An agreement that it doesn't have to accept. It's the word that's on the talk, whether it's in writing, whether it refers to CR2A. What's the magic difference?
But he also made another ruling before that. So I think you have to take into consideration, A, that the judge said that he does not necessarily always accept, agreed continuances. So it is still a discretionary call on his part as to whether or not to grant the continuance. And that this was a case that had been waiting there for about a year. And the reason that was given for the continuance was because it was the Super Bowl. So I think with that passage of time, this judge could have decided, this is not an okay. And the prosecutor had objected to continuances in the past. And this judge had made two rulings with respect to continuances. So this judge certainly could have and indicated that he had in the past not granted agreed continuances.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honor, I've reflected on your question, and I'm not sure I know the answer to it. But with respect to Judge, if Judge Urich did not honor the affidavit, he had no authority to address the severance motion. So our position would be that motion would be void. And as far as practical things.
My question with regard to that is, okay, does it have to be a final ruling, or does it just have to be some sort of ruling? Because he made a ruling with regard to the severance, but it wasn't a final ruling, because according to the rule, it doesn't become final unless it's made at trial and denied, and that's what we would review. So does it have to be a final ruling?
No. He has no authority. He's supposed to get out. The statute is pretty clear about that.
The case law, because the statute isn't clear. I don't think the statute's clear at all in terms of the what happens next. The case law talks about divesting of authority to affect the merits, make rulings that affect the merits, something along those lines. And so does that mean it has to be a final order, or does a temporary order do that? What has to trigger? It seems to be it's got to be something more than just being wrong on whether you recuse and then doing nothing else. And so what does the something else have to be?
Well, you know, I look at it from the point of view of the litigant, and we didn't want Judge Urich on the case for the precise reason of rulings relating to pretrial. And the prosecutor did. And we rely upon, this is really the setting of an action or motion or proceeding down for trial or hearing. That's in reality what's taking place. We have a mass processing center where cases are either confirmed or continued, and as I mentioned, the ones that fight it out on the continuance are done it before a different court. So in practical terms, we rely on Dixon. This is really an administrative thing. But if it's wrong, he could have won that motion to sever with a different judge. He had that opportunity that was lost to him, and it did impact the trial if he had could have gotten a severance. There were complete differences between the cases. So we would also ask the court to review the other issues that we believe have merit as well. But Mr. Lyle, we respectfully submit, was not given a fair trial and should get a new opportunity for a fair trial. Thank you.
Thank you. All right.